Well, hello, welcome to Pints with Treebeard. I'm Josh Edgren. I'm a pastor and teacher in Moscow, Idaho, and I'm joined by Jameson Winter.
Yes, I'm Jameson Winter, and I'm the dean of the upper school here at Augustine School in Jackson, Tennessee. I have the pleasure of teaching Lord of the Rings to sixth graders each year, among other things. So, Josh, what are we talking about today?
The last week we talked about parenthood broadly. What are children? Why do children matter? Today we're going to focus a little bit more on the role of the father particularly. So perhaps broadly speaking, our question is, why does fatherhood matter in a cosmic sense? Why is it significant, not just biologically, but why is it significant theologically, spiritually, philosophically, etc.? So I think one question that maybe will help us get at that is, to what extent are the duties of the father and the mother interchangeable, right? So to what extent, if at all, do the father and the mother do basically the same thing, and just one of them's larger and hairier, right? Is it the case that if the father wanted, he could stay home with the children and the mother could go off to work? Is it the case that, you know, the mother must prepare the meals and the father must be the one to go out and be the breadwinner? Is there more than just socially acceptable, or, you know, evolutionary biology, like, well, the man's bigger and stronger, so he goes out and fights the wolves and the woman does other things. She can make the babies, so there you are, right? Is there more than that? And if so, why? So thoughts on that question generally, and then we'll get into answering it.
Yeah, I think the first thing I would say is maybe to rephrase the question slightly, or maybe my answer will rephrase it. So I would say that the duties of a father and mother, as you've said, are not interchangeable, although they overlap, if that makes sense. They're okay. Oriented towards the same end. When I think of interchangeable, I think you've got this size 8 bolt to screw into your car, and if you break that bolt, you can take it out and put a completely different size 8 bolt back into the spot, and it fits perfectly. So no, right. They're not interchangeable. I think that's the wrong word. But I would say they overlap in terms of what they're oriented towards. And if you want to think about it like workload, you could say the workload they share. I would say more so the effects overlap. A good father and a good mother cause different things in their children. They bring out different things in their children. They also sometimes bring out the same thing. For instance, loving to tell the truth, right? If a child loves to tell the truth, a mother can draw that out of him and a father can draw that out of him. Even so, they do that oftentimes in different ways, or by relating to the child in slightly nuanced, sometimes very nuanced ways.
Right. So you could broadly say that both father and mother are to love the child, but the love of a father and the love of a mother will look very different.
That's right. And maybe even sometimes they might look the same from the outside, right? If I give my son a hug, it looks the same more or less as my wife giving my son a hug.
Arms wrapped around torso, right?
Exactly. It's more or less the same kind of action. So you could say, well, okay, fathers and mothers can both hug their children. Great. But what does it mean for a father to hug a child? And what does it mean for a mother to hug a child? I think is different, at least in certain ways. It's obviously communicating love, but it's doing more than that.
And so let's sort of peer into why that is. So what makes the love of a father and love of a mother different? And is this just sociology, right? Is it just we're conditioned to do it that way? Or is it go deeper? Is father love and mother love different all the way down? And if so, how and why? We talked last week about how the revelation that we're given of God, that he is Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. These are, in the one sense, these are pictures, these are images, these are metaphors. But in another sense, well, they are. But we talked last week about how the metaphor runs the other way, right? God did not reveal himself to us and say, let me think. How do I show you what I am? Ooh, I know. You've already got this thing called fatherhood and sonhood. Ooh, great, perfect. I'll use that to show you what I'm like. It's actually the reverse. We're not projecting things onto God. Rather, what was the term you used last time? Theopomorphic?
Yes, yeah, theopomorphic language rather than anthropomorphic, which gives non-human entities human-like qualities. Theopomorphic language gives humans God-like qualities.
Exactly. I love it. That's excellent. So that's exactly what's going on. The human fatherhood is projection or is shadow, image, example of divine fatherhood, right? So God, when he reveals himself to us, he reveals himself to us as Father, Son, and Spirit. This is the most fundamental thing that we have access to, right? So we've got knowledge of God from his scriptures, and God is the fundamental thing, right? The idea of one-isms and two-isms, does that ring a bell, right? So you got some religions that say God, there's only one thing in the universe. Everything's the same. But you've got some philosophies or worldviews that say, no, there's two types of thing. There's God and not God, right? And so Christianity, we would hold that it's a two-ism, that there are two categories of being. There's God and not God. So things that are not God derive from God. In a sense, I mean, they're not extensions of his being. There's a real and fundamental distinction between the creature and the creator. But we derive life, being, wisdom, knowledge, power, etc. from him. So human fatherhood is projection, extension, derivative of divine fatherhood.
I think that this is something Christians maybe understand by nature. And so you could say perhaps man understands this by nature, right? That our fathers teach us something unique about God as father. Pagans might not call it fatherhood, but I think they respond to their fathers in a unique way, just like we do. And so they recognize there's something particular about this authority that's been placed over me that I am to submit to and to follow and to allow to instruct me and raise me up into maturity that reflects a divine human relationship. For Christians, that's much deeper because we recognize that our Heavenly Father, again, is not only that he is Father within the Trinity. He is the Father to the Son through the Spirit, but he is also Father to the creation. He calls Adam his son. So he's Father on multiple levels in multiple ways that all in maybe various and maybe similar ways teach us what it means to be a father as a man. You know, it's fascinating to see that although his fatherhood within the Trinity, right, the Father's relationship to the eternal Son is something that we don't participate in directly within the Trinity. Like you said, we are not God. We are distinct from him. It's not like we're some weird extension of him into the created world in a metaphysical way. We do still get access to him as Father because he's our Father. He is Father of not just the eternal Son, but also mankind, which is a beautiful reality. So it's a personal connection. What does that say about our role as fathers, our duties as fathers, and what it means to be a father here on earth? Well, it says a great number of things. First and foremost might be, I don't know if you'd call it first, but the first thing that comes to my mind is that a father delights in cultivating his children to maturity, right? He delights in helping them to become what they were made to be and fulfill their telos.
It's interesting you bringing up the point about pagan and Christian. Something you said jogged my memory there, that just that God is Father in multiple ways, right? He's Father of the Son. We participate in that divine sonship when we're united with Christ, even though we're not part of the ontological Trinity, but we are united to the Son, right? But then also you brought out, which is essential, that Adam is a son of God, right? And so even apart from the work of redemption, we are sons of the Father, right? We're sons of Adam. Adam's a son of God. And that intersects with the pagan understanding in a lovely way when Paul quotes, is it Epimenides? I forget. Who is it that he quotes in Acts 17?
That sounds right. Epimenides rings a bell.
He says, "For in him we live and move and have our being, as one of your own poets has said, for we are also his offspring," right? So Paul is quoting this pagan writer and playing off this common notion that we are children of God,
right?
That God stands apart from creation and is in a fatherly relationship to it. Interestingly, even on the biological level, we have this picture of the otherness of God, right? When a child is born, the child literally comes from the mother's body, right? And that's obvious, right? You see, you know, the mother, the belly grows, right? She consumes resources, the belly grows, right? Baby is part of her, baby comes out of her, right? The connection to the father is different. He's not connected in the same way, right?
Yes.
The baby doesn't come from him in the same way as it comes from the mother. He stands apart from it, but bound to it covenantally. And I think we see that biologically when a child, like there's this, the fact that that is how a child is made is picture of God, right? Picture of the otherness of God. But then you also see the child's experience of the father. You know, the mother nurses the baby, the mother snuggles the baby and dresses the baby and puts the baby down for naps. And the father is away, but he comes back at punctuated intervals, but he's other than the child. But I think you said cultivating. He's always cultivating the child while being separate from the child. So he's the gardener. And this is why the seed metaphor is apt. The father plants his seed and then he cultivates it over time. He's the gardener. He stands bound to the thing, but distinct from it. And this is a picture of how God is.
Interestingly, I hadn't tied that as closely to the picture of who God is and how he relates to us, but I see exactly what you're saying. I do, however, tell that to new fathers consistently as an encouragement to them, because so often you have a father who hasn't had a child yet and this baby is born and he's wondering, where do I fit? What do I do? Because I haven't, oftentimes, even through pregnancy, it takes a long time for many of us for it to sink in. I'm a father. I have a child. We don't feel the baby moving around. We don't see the baby. And so it's hard to feel that kind of connection in some ways that are not true. Those ways are not true for our wives, because they have such an intimate union from the moment of conception. It's affecting everything about their bodies and how they experience the day in positive ways and in the negative ways, right? Morning sickness and all of these things. It's a constant reminder, like, yeah, I have a human growing inside of me. But I tell fathers who are new fathers, don't fret if it feels like there's distance, right? If it feels like you don't have this connection yet that your wife seems to have. And maybe the corollary there for wives is like, give it time. Don't be frustrated with your husband that he doesn't interact with your baby in the exact same ways you do, or feels this kind of disconnect, because that grows as the child grows and it just gets better and better. And I think that's something that we share in, right? It gets better and better, as much as, you know, Megan will tell you that she loves these sweet times when the babies are 3-4 weeks old and they're just, you know, sitting in your arms all day. She still delights more and more in our children as they get older. And so do I. She also delights in getting to see me interact with them more, because there is that distance, right? And it's not only that I go to work, it's also just the nature of a little child wanting their mother, right? This is where my food comes from. This is where I go when I'm crying or when I'm upset. It's just very natural. And so to see me, for her, right, to see me gaining more and more ground and cultivating them is just a joy that she delights in, that is so important. So that's something I always try to encourage the new fathers with, because it's so easy to think, am I doing this right? Like, do I love my child enough?
Yeah, right.
But you do. It's just different, and that's okay.
You're exactly right. You're exactly right about that. And the dangers and the temptations and thus the duties for father and mother are somewhat opposite, right? My wife read something somewhere that talked about, you know, motherhood is the long goodbye, right? It's the, you know, you have this child and you're intimately connected, but as time goes on, they have more and more and more independence. And what's the danger? What's the temptation for the mother is to hold on, right? To hold on past what is right and fitting, to smother, right? Lewis has that great and chilling episode in The Great Divorce, right? When it's the mother's love, so to speak, that would pull her child back to hell, right? So that he could be with her. Whereas the father has the opposite tendency. His tendency is to beget and forget, and faithfulness for him requires a leaning in, right? A presence, a cultivation, right? We keep coming back to that metaphor. I think it's fitting.
Really quickly on that note, you brought up Lewis, and this shows up all over his work. I mean, he's drawing on such an old concept there. You see it in the Greeks, the idea of a smothering mother who overwhelms her, you know, her child, and inhibits them from what it is that they're supposed to be. But he plays
a devouring love.
Right, a devouring love. He plays on this so well in Until We Have Faces, right, with Orwell, who is not a direct thinking, mother, yeah, but is a motherly figure to her younger half sister, Psyche. And she realizes at the end of that book, I have consumed her with my love. And in fact, everyone I ever thought I loved in a noble way, I've actually destroyed and devoured them with my love. And you see that pitted against her father, who does exactly what you're saying, right? Her father is abusive and almost rejects her as his child at all and holds her at arm's length. And so the pits are on different sides, right? Which means I think we can see that the virtues will also be somewhat different. They'll be oriented towards combating those pitfalls.
That's great. Great connection to Till We Have Faces. That's really good. So speaking of the differences between father and mother, you know, one way to put it is that the father is oriented outwards, right? The mother is oriented inwards. You know, you sometimes see that talked about as, you know, the father or the male is the line, right? Going outwards, the woman or the female, the mother is the circle, right? Connecting, containing inwards. And that has different duties, but also different temptations. One aspect of that outward facing aspect of the father's nature is that he's the covenant head. And that's language that we use a lot, especially in Reformed circles. But let's just talk about what does it mean for the father to be the covenant head? Where does that come from? So this aspect of the father being the covenantal head, being the representative, as we'll get into in a minute, derives from God the Father, right? So we're told in 1 Corinthians 11, which talks about a whole bunch of things, including head coverings, which we're not going to get into. But as a part of that extended head covering discussion, Paul tells us this. He says, I would have you know, the head of every man is Christ. The head of the woman is the man. And the head of Christ is God, right? Meaning it seems God the Father. So you have this hierarchy, this order given to us that God the Father is the head of Christ. Christ is the head of the man, right? The man is the head of the woman. So there's this line drawn. The husband, the father, is the head of his family in an analogous way to how God the Father is the head of the Godhead. Feel like we're skating near heresy, but I don't think we're being heretical. Pretty much just said what Paul said. So how do you understand the human father being the covenant head of his family?
It's interesting to bring in 1 Corinthians 11:3 because you could take that one of two ways. And like you said, we need to be careful not to skirt into heresy. It seems to me that when Paul says that the head of Christ is God, we have to understand he's talking about Christ incarnate, right? The God-man as the new Adam, the new humanity. And so what does it mean for God to be the Messiah's head, which is Christ, right? Christ, Messiah, those are the same word. What does it mean for God to be his head? Well, it means something analogous to what it means that Christ is our head in the church and that we as husbands are head within our families, which seems to be kind of an orienting role. Obviously, we could say, first and foremost, you're the covenant representative for whatever group you are the head of, right? You're the covenant representative of your family. If you're a father and a husband, you are the covenant representative, or Christ rather is the covenant representative of the church before the Father. And so what then does it mean that God is the head of Christ? Well, it seems to be something related to Christ. If you think about Christ in the garden, right? What is he praying? He's praying ultimately that the will of the Father would be done, right? He's orienting his will, his emotions, his life, and his death for that matter that's coming towards the will of the greater. He's submitting himself to even suffering on the cross, knowing how treacherous it will be, how painful, how horrific it will be. Not just the physical side of it, but to suffer under the wrath of God and to bear his wrath for sins. And so it seems that, yes, we are the covenant representatives, but what does that mean? You could think of it perhaps like we are directing our families towards the will of God, and we are representing, we are standing in the place of them before God, and then we are also standing in God's place towards our family. Not that they worship us, but that they see us and they should see God through us, just as we we should see God through the Messiah, right? No one has seen the Father except that he has seen me. Yeah, I mean, it makes me think of Job, I guess, making sacrifices for his children early in the mornings, making sacrifices even for sins that his children may not realize they've committed in Job 1. That's a detail that we can so easily just kind of skate past because it's not the whole point of the book. We know what's about to happen to Job, and so we don't even think about who is this righteous man who's waking up to make physical sacrifices, a lengthy and laborious process for sins that maybe his children committed in case they didn't make a sacrifice for their sin, right? He's stepping in as covenant head. He's saying, I will step in and represent my children to God, and I will take responsibility for them before him.
Yeah, so it seems like you have two words. So responsibility is key. Then also representation, right? Both of those are at play here. So the father is to take responsibility for his family, and also he is to represent his family before God. And we'll talk about that in more detail later. He's to represent the father's authority. He's to represent the father's holiness. He's to represent the father's law, all to his family, but also he's to represent his family to God. I want to think about how we see covenant heads functioning throughout the scriptures, right? So you see many examples of covenants throughout the scriptures. And one way that that works, or one way that's helpful for me at least to think about this, is if you're a representative, then in some extent, what counts for you counts for everybody. What you do counts for everybody. So in a Republican form of government, the people send a representative, and the idea is whatever he says is what we say, which gives us all a good chuckle. But you know, that's the idea. That's the idea, right? What he does, we do.
Really quickly, let me just interject how important it is to understand that that means your covenant head must be trustworthy and must have the best interest of the covenant people at heart.
Right. But going off of that, he doesn't need to be trustworthy to be a covenant head. He's the covenant head regardless of whether he's trustworthy or not. And so if he's faithful, blessing comes to the people. And if he's unfaithful, curses come to the people. We see that throughout the scriptures. Adam is the representative. What he does, all of his people do, right? What counts for him counts for them all. And so when he sins, it's everybody sinning because he's the head. Then you've got other examples, you know, the reversal. You've got Abraham. Abraham's faith counts for all of his descendants in a way that blessing, God says, through you, there's going to be blessing to all the nations. That he's the father of the faithful. Blessing comes to the people when they have a faithful covenant head, and curses come to the people when they have a faithless covenant head. And this is, tell me about this. Where do you see that true for fathers in the family?
I think this comes out in a number of ways, and some of them are obvious and some of them are less obvious. Some people would point to a text like Jeremiah 31 and say, well, okay, hang on, each man is being judged for his own sins now, taking this as under the new covenant, right? We won't have our teeth set on edge, as he said, because our fathers ate sour grapes. Even people who say that will still say things like, your father will affect the kind of household that you have in an inordinate way. For instance, one of the clearest outcomes of success by basically any metric that you measure, whether you're measuring financial success and stability later, the future marriages of children, education, all manner of things, the far and away greatest indicator is, do they have a loving father in the home or not? And it's not the same if they have a mother and no father as if they have a father and no mother. It is better that they have a father and no mother than that they have a mother and no father, measuring in those terms, right? And so clearly, there's something true that you just have to recognize as a human, whether you're a believer, unbeliever, living in this country, another point in time, you know, modern day, 1,000 years from now, it'll be the same thing, that your father has this special kind of effect on you. And I think what you're getting at, I would make the case that it's because he's the covenant head of the family, whether he wants to be or not, whether he recognizes that category or not. He can be, you know, a pagan, he can be an atheist, he can be whatever he wants, right? Whatever he believes about the world doesn't change the fact that he entered into marriage with his wife, and he is the representative before the true God, Yahweh, whether he wants to be or not. And so what he does, what he thinks, how he lives will affect his family. So there's a couple of examples, one kind of normal and one more extreme. You know, one of our pastors talks about his grandfather being a very angry man and abusive to his wife and to the kids. And his father learned that and took it up a notch, right? So his father, when he was little, was abusive to them and his mother. He grew up under that. And now he saw his father's anger at his grandfather being manifested in those interchanges, and then had anger for a second generation now building up inside of him because it's all been passed down to him in that way. And before he came to faith, he lived that way. His testimony is just amazing in the way that God totally transformed him and healed him of that anger. But it's just a very simple kind of straight line example of how this compounds generation by generation if sin is left unchecked. The more extreme version of that, I would say, was a friend I know, and I don't remember all the details, so I won't go into much detail here anyway, but a friend of mine mentioned just this kind of, I don't know if you would call it demonic oppression or not. I think he would describe it that way. I can't remember all the details, but he would wake up and just be filled with rage and not know where it was coming from or different things like that, and struggled with drinking and all of these things as a young man. And lo and behold, finds out later that his father was dealing with similar sins, right? And similar things, similar patterns of living. And so eventually, right, he again repents and changes. But there's even this kind of, if you want to think about it this way, I don't know, there might be a better way to phrase it, this kind of covenantal allowance for his children or his wife to engage in these kind of dark practices, and it just bleeds into the home. So I don't think we should be surprised, because we're not just physical beings, we're spiritual beings. We shouldn't be surprised if something like that shows up, right? If you're a man and you're pursuing an adulterous relationship or you're looking at pornography all the time, you shouldn't be surprised if your sons follow suit in your household and you discover it, because in some sense you're saying to God, this is how I run my household. This is okay here, right? And that should really make us tremble. It kind of gets back to last week, right? Becoming a husband and a father, or a mother for that matter, in similar ways, helps you to realize your own pursuit of holiness needs to be kind of ratcheted up because your kids depend on it, right? Not in a material way, but because you are their example primarily. And you recognize, I can't just excuse my sin and expect it not to affect my kids.
That's right. And that's an immense weight that, yes, I agreed, every father, I hope, does feel just naturally, and especially this aspect of fatherhood, namely the covenant representative nature of it, should make him quake in his boots a little bit, right? But he should look around and think, golly, I could ruin everything for everybody. And it would take me about 20 minutes. Like, I could take 20 minutes and ruin everything for everybody. Yikes. And God made it that way. God did it that way on purpose. And it's for blessing as well as for cursing. So you can think of this, the examples you gave are great. And you could think of it being, you know, the sins of the fathers passing on to the sins of the sons and becoming sins of the sons just by, you know, practical means, like, well, if there's dirty magazines around the house, the sons will find them, right? But there's also spiritual aspects, right? That the father's faithlessness makes his sons vulnerable, right, in a way that they wouldn't have been otherwise. But also you can think of it in maybe a more practical, down-to-earth sort of way, reputation. That's sort of a way to think about this that is helpful. The father is building the family name, and he's the one who goes out there and says, this is what it means to be part of my household. And then when his sons come of age, if their father was faithful, they now stand on his shoulders. And they can now labor upon the name that he built, right? Ah, to be a Johnson means this, right? And now people will they walk in, and already people trust them because of their father's faithfulness. And reverse, right? The faithlessness of a father ruins his name, right? And he ruins the name he gives his sons. And now, to be a Johnson means you're a skunk, right? So I don't think that's the be all end all of it. But that's, I think it's a helpful way to think about it. And it's more, but certainly not less than that.
Certainly, certainly. And just to maybe end on an encouraging note, you know, for this idea, you know, we have so many examples of the positive blessings that come to children through their father's faithfulness. I think about just in a kind of basic way, and maybe the most important way, my grandfather was faithful in leading his household well, caring for my grandmother, and raising children within the context of the church, blessing them with the gospel, and his children became believers, right? And so my father is now raising me, having been raised by a Christian man. He's reaping benefits from that and then surpassing his father in fatherhood and has passed that inheritance on to me and to my sisters. And now, as the third generation here, and it could go back, I just don't know much about my family beyond my grandparents, you know, but at least third generation here, I'm seeking to take what he got from my grandfather and then what he added to it himself and what the Lord taught him through unique experiences and make a return on that, right? And surpass my father. And he's told me as much, right? I want you to surpass me in the faith. And that's what I want for my sons, right? And for my daughters, I want them to surpass me in the faith, to give them what I have and say, here, go do more with this for the Lord.
That's right. I think thinking in those terms of like, this is a spiritual wealth. This is a spiritual family fortune that I'm passing down. But the beautiful thing is it doesn't divide, right?
Yeah.
You know, like
it multiplies.
Not like I have to split it amongst all my kids. You all get all of it, right? And now you all go out and labor on all of it.
Yeah. And I see that. I mean, again, I can testify to his legacy of faith that my grandfather left. This is what I said at his funeral, essentially, just calling attention to the fact that sure, he had quirks and things that, you know, he was certainly a sinful man and faults that we would all recognize and all of that. Right. And we all loved him and cherished the time that we had with him. But let's just take a second and look at the dozens of people who are sitting in this room who believe the gospel because he was faithful, right?
And that desire for our children to surpass us is admirable. And that's the spirit, you know? So that's what we ought to be thinking. We ought to be thinking, okay, I stand before God as representative for my children. All right, I need to be as faithful as I can so that my children will be blessed. And then they will stand on my shoulders and go beyond, right? And that's the vision. But this weighty responsibility that I have to steward their souls, I need to give good return on investment that I've received. And we talked about how examples of faithlessness, right? And also examples of faithfulness. I love, and we may differ, but I love the second commandment, right? That talks about those who break this commandment, the sins, God will visit the iniquity of the fathers on the sons to the third and fourth generation, right? So the sins of the fathers will come upon the sons, but the blessings of faithfulness will go to 1,000 generations, right? So the curses for faithlessness are third and fourth generation. The blessings for faithfulness are 1,000 generations. The blessings for faithfulness, it's not tit for tat. The blessings for faithfulness blow the curses for faithlessness out of the water. And that's comfort. That's comfort.
Right. And I mean, whatever you want to do with that text, like anybody who's listening who would disagree with that can still affirm the central idea there, which is that grace overcomes sin. That sin cannot prevent the gospel from prevailing. Just like I mentioned, one of our pastors, right? Sin in his life and that had been kind of passed down and trained in him for generations could not prevent the work of the Lord to turn him from it and to bring him to repentance and faith. And praise God for that, right? Praise God that his grace and his love has utterly broken and shattered the hold that death and sin has on us as people, and that Christ's resurrection vindicates him, right, as the Son of God and allows him to bind the strong man and now plunder his house, right? I'm taking the nations from Satan, not because I bowed down and worshiped him in the desert, which is what he offers. The kingdoms of the earth have been given to me so that I can give them to whom I will. Bow down and worship me and I'll make them yours. He says, no, I'm going to take them from you because I'm going to defeat you. I'm going to conquer the nations and receive them as an inheritance, and then present them to the Father, right? And that's the beautiful reality of the gospel, that he has overcome these powers. And so we can just sit back and be thankful for the blessings that God gives. I also think, I mean, this is maybe a side tangent to some degree, but I also think that should really just put into perspective our attitude towards our fathers and our grandfathers and mothers and grandmothers, yeah, right. Right? You look at their faults and you see them and they're glaring. Stop and just focus a little bit more on the blessings that God has given you through your parents and grandparents. It's very easy to seize on their sins. It's very easy to complain or to make light of them and laugh at, like, oh, remember when grandma did this? Remember how grandfather always did this? Yada, yada, yada. But it just work against that kind of bent, because it's one thing to recognize that our parents or our grandparents had faults. So often, though, we actually don't appreciate them for the good things that they did. And it's just not from wisdom that we do that. And so that should be our attitude, right? How did the Father bless me through my father? How did the Father bless me through my mother, despite their shortcomings, despite the things that I want to do differently?
And that's just simple golden rule, right?
Yeah.
How would
yeah.
I want my children to look at me? I'm not expecting my children to look at me and say, man, he had no faults, right? I'm expecting and hoping that they will look at me and go, you know, in spite of his faults, he was faithful in these ways and I'm grateful. And so let us do the same. Maybe to wrap up with this final thought, it could be tempting for a dad to receive this word and to think, golly, I have to be the covenant head. Like I'm the picture of God the Father. This is a huge weight on my skinny little shoulders, right? I can't. And then it's possible that he goes, it's not fair. You know, like this, it's not fair that I have to do that, right? Why do I have to do that? And I think that the answer is what you were saying a minute ago, which is God has made the world such that blessings come to the people through the covenant representative. And the fundamental example of that is Christ himself, right? So you, Dad, you're responsible for your family, and blessings will come to them because of your obedience, like you are a member of Christ, and blessings come to you from Christ's obedience, right? So you are the recipient of great and abundant grace, because Jesus said, yep, I'm going to take all of them on. I will stand in the gap, right? Take me, not them. And because he did that, now you receive fellowship with the Father. Now you receive the adoption as sons, justification, sanctification, eternal glory. And so you now are presented with a very small version of that same choice, right? But you stand having already received the grace that Christ won for you. So you're standing holding it, and now you're called to copy him. So be encouraged, right? He's already done it. You just get to copy him.
Yeah, and live in it, right? I mean, Paul says in Ephesians that we are his workmanship created for good works, but these are the works that he set before us from the foundation of the world that we might walk in them. So wait, you're saying, and I love talking about this with students, because especially in middle school, it's just like blowing their minds. They are struggling to understand, because it is a mystery in many ways. But you're saying that he put these works in front of us from before the foundation of the earth, so that we would walk in them and actually do them. But like, who's doing them? Because he put them there, but I have to walk in them. Yes, to both. That's right. But it's this freeing kind of mystery where we get to say, I get to live from a place of faith and a place of security in the love of God. And that all of that we talked about, right? I mentioned about, you know, God's love conquering Satan and death and sin in the world and calling the nations to himself and all of this, that's applied to us so that we get to live out of it, out of that kind of victory in life. It's just a beautiful reality.
Amen.
So as a final kind of question to consider together, what about a bad father? We've talked about how a bad father brings curses to his children, right? If you gamble all your money away, and you leave your children destitute, right? That's obvious. Okay. and we've talked about how a good father is standing in the place of God, representing God's commands, and teaching his children and teaching his wife to walk in God's ways and to say, to, like you said, to be a Johnson means to be this, right? To be this kind of person, to be a Christian, to be a God-fearer. But we can kind of understand how that represents God. How is it representing God to gamble all of your money away and leave no inheritance to your children? Is he still a picture of God?
Did you know that my great-grandfather did that?
I didn't.
My great-grandfather gambled away their house and then left them. Poof, bye. And then died in Singapore. But that's neither here nor there. So yes, it's a tough question in some respects. So I want to think about it this way. Yes and no, right? So is a lousy father still a picture of God? Yes, he's a bad picture of God, right? He is a picture of God. He is a bad picture of God, okay? Here's maybe an example. Let's say that someone was cast to play a role in a play, right? Jameson, you're cast to play Hamlet, right? And now you can play Hamlet well, or you can play Hamlet poorly. So there's this standard that you're called to live up to. You know what Hamlet is because it's revealed to you in the text. And now opening night, bam, lights go up. Here you are. What you gonna do, right? And so even if you play, but here's the thing, even if you forget all your lines or decide to start telling knock-knock jokes, you're still Hamlet. It's just you're doing a really bad job, right? And so I think that imagine if you're sitting in the audience, you're not sitting in the audience, you're on stage. I'm sitting in the audience and I'm looking at you and you're juggling and telling knock-knock jokes as Hamlet. And I'm thinking, huh, he's a really bad Hamlet. Why am I thinking that, right? Because I'm comparing you to this standard that I have some sense, right? And so you're still actually revealing Hamlet. You're revealing Hamlet in the negative. Your failure to play Hamlet well is revealing the true Hamlet, right? And I think the same thing can be true for a father, right? If he gambles away their house and leaves them, he's still revealing God. He's revealing God in the negative, and he's showing what God is not. And everyone can look at him and say, wow, I do now know better what God is because it's not that. But then also one other thing, and I don't want to be trivial, but going back to what we were saying before, you cannot avoid the biological. And I think the biological is a picture of God the Father. So when a man begets a child, he is imaging God. And there is, he can't avoid that, right? He can't do that part badly. He either does it or he doesn't, right? So I think that in that sense, the fact that he has done the physical act means that he is a picture of God. And that makes his moral failings all the grosser.
Yeah, I think it's actually even more than just doing a bad job. And, you know, some people might look at that and say, okay, that's what God isn't, because that's bad and God must be good. When actually, I think the opposite happens most of the time. They say, oh, that is, you're telling the truth about God, and so I hate God. Right? So many people reject the gospel and reject Christianity because they have problems with the idea of a divine father, because they have problems with their real father, their biological father.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you're saying somebody could watch Hamlet and say, this is a stupid play.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, that's right. Like, Hamlet is such a terrible character. Shakespeare really botched this one because they don't actually know what the true Hamlet is supposed to be. So I think you can see this really clearly a lot of times with people who are famous and well-known. One of the clear ones that stands out in my mind is Christopher Hitchens. When he was alive and doing debates against Christians, he would always spar with them intellectually and come up with these at least thoughtful arguments many times. You could see how someone who didn't know the truth would come to that argument and make that.
Sure, yeah.
And then inevitably, I saw it again and again, right, with so many people that he would debate, it devolves into this emotional state where he says, how could you worship a tyrannical big brother style God who watches everything that you do and calls out every fault and is just waiting to catch you and is so insidious that he would take his son and make him become a bloody sacrifice and torture his son to death? How could you worship that? Which just betrays, right, clearly there's a deep-seated anger against the idea of a father here. And that's just so often the case, sadly, that people are actually lied to by their fathers about who God is. And so they believe the lie, they buy into it, and it leads them away from the truth. It leads them away from faith, which is part of what we have to recognize we're overcoming, especially if you have somebody directly, you know, in a situation where that kind of experience with their father has just hardened their hearts. But even if it's not that drastic, right? Even if they don't hate their father, they're just, you know, they maybe hold on to some of his sins from childhood and it's really burdened them. We're still trying to help them see, okay, look beyond him, right? You have a heavenly father and that's actually your true father, the father, right? That's the hope that we're trying to point them to.
Amen. I think that wraps us up, sir. In conclusion, recommend us a book.
Well, I didn't plan this, but I'll stick with it. Since I referenced Till We Have Faces at the beginning, that is actually the book that I wrote down for my recommendation, which is funny because I was planning on changing it. And it's okay, I'll change it for the next one. I just finished a book that I'll recommend in the next episode. But yeah, Till We Have Faces is my book recommendation by C.S. Lewis. It is a retelling of the story of Cupid and Psyche. And if you're wondering what's C.S. Lewis doing retelling a pagan myth, it might be interesting to know that when he read the story as a young man, you know, in his late teens, early 20s, he said, this story is wrong, right? Something about this story is being told incorrectly. And he didn't mean factually wrong, like we changed it over time. He meant narratively, there's something wrong about this story and I could write it better, which is just very audacious and maybe a little arrogant of a young man to take this story that's been passed down for, you know, a couple thousand years or more and say, I can do it better. Then he does, right? He tries to write it several times. It ends up being one of the last things he writes in his life. Post-conversion, he finally, as a Christian, can reconcile the ideas that he'd been playing around with.
It was his favorite. It was his favorite work, right?
Yeah, it was. And many people who read it the first time say, why is this his favorite work? And I don't understand the people who really have read this a lot and studied it saying it's his best work, but it really might be his best work. They're the people who say that, I tend to look at what they've said and why they're saying it and think you're onto something here, right? Lewis is hitting at something deeper and in a truer way than I think most of his writings, which is a big, you know, a big thing to say about Lewis, who gets so many things so right. So yeah, Till We Have Faces, it's a narrative. It's a pretty easy read in that sense. It's not heady and theological.
That's right. And Jameson, is it fair to say that this one is a little bit strange on your first read?
Oh,
so if
certainly.
You read it the first time, you go, huh, what was that? It's okay.
Yes, yeah. I think my impression of reading the last few chapters where the whole story kind of changes, everything that you've read up to that point changes when you read the last few chapters. And it's hard to describe what I mean by that without telling you the whole thing. But my first encounter with that was, oh, this is way different than I thought it was and way more meaningful and impactful. And I get now why people told me to read this book, and yet I still don't get it. I need to read it again. And so I've gone through it maybe 3 or 4 times, and now it's really starting to sink in.
Because the end is so like, oh, now it all comes into focus. You really have to go back and read the first, you know, 3/4 of it again in order to understand, because you have to read it in light of the end, but you can't have read the end until you read, right. Yeah, okay. Yeah, great, great one. Great, great recommendation. My pick this week is Cry the Beloved Country by Alan Payton, which is one of my all-time favorites. I actually just went back and reread it maybe 3 or 4 months ago, and it was just as good as I remembered. It's a story of South Africa. It's a story of South Africa in the early 50s, late 40s, early 50s. And it is written by a white man who's reflecting upon the nature of South Africa, what it is, what it's not, what is justice, what is social justice, what does love look like in a very, very broken place in society. I will spoil this for you. The reason why it's appropriate for this topic is it's about two fathers and a black preacher and a white landowner. And the black preacher's son goes off to Johannesburg, gets involved in crime, ends up killing the son of the white landowner. Okay. The white landowner and the black preacher live in the same small town in South Africa. And so the story is about them going through this event very differently and how they both respond to it. And it's a fascinating picture of fatherhood Fatherhood gone well, fatherhood gone poorly. It's a picture of justice, charity. What does charity look like in a very broken society? What does what's the answer? How do you fix the things that are wrong? I'll leave it that. Except for I think that his answer is correct. So there you are. Cry the beloved country, Alan Payton.
Well, that's wonderful. I've heard you mention the book, but never heard you talk about it. So I'm excited to read it now. And I will actually pick it up because I know more than the title and that you recommend it, which is maybe good enough, but I'm more motivated now. Well, that's all the time we have for today. Thank you for joining us. We hope that you've been edified. If you have any questions for us or anything that you'd like us to discuss at some point, you can email us at pintswithtreebeard@gmail.com. And we'll see you next time.
Cheerio.